Hello, my lovelies. Welcome to Out on the Edge, where each week, co-hosts Judy McCord, Robin Hamilton, and Betty Priou celebrate the rich diversity of our 55-plus LGBTQ-plus community, our queer elders, who we are, where we came from, and what we continue to bring to the party in these interesting times. Our guest today is Harry Rosenberg, age 89, one of our gay elders who has led a full and wonderful life. We've had the pleasure of getting to know Harry over potlucks and coffees. Harry's one of the most warm and welcoming people I know. His story is inspiring. Before we get started, we'd like to give a shout out to WCOMLP, Chapel Hill Carborough, at 103.5 FM for hosting our show. Out on the Edge is brought to you by the LGBTQ Plus Senior Resource Team of the Orange County, North Carolina Department on Aging. We are deeply grateful for their guidance and support. We acknowledge and honor that the town of Carborough and surrounding land was originally part of the Saponi People's Territory, which also included the Eno, Tutelo, and Shikori Nation. All righty, Betty and Harry, on with the show.
Great, great. Thank you, Judy. And Harry, again, thank you so much for being here. We've been having some really great conversations the last few days preparing for this. Like Judy said, you're 89, and I was musing today on the fact that you will probably be the eldest gay elder we talked to on this show. I know no one else in your good health, and your age.
Right.
So there's that. So we're gonna talk about how to stay healthy too. But the other thing I learned is that you didn't really start living as a gay man until about age 74. So I think this is going to be a very wide-ranging conversation today. Your 80-plus years living here in the U.S. and how you got here. And, and just a reminder to our audience, those of us who are older, like Harry, we lived in times when there were no role models for gay people. You couldn't figure out what to do with your feelings, right? We've talked about that. So it was a really different time, and I think you're going to learn a lot of powerful things today. So, Harry, thank you for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Yes. And so why don't we start with the question, the thing we were just talking about. When did you know you were gay?
Oh, when did I know I was gay? Probably when I was a junior in college and I had some role models that I didn't have earlier in my life.
What time period would that be about?
That would have been around 1956, 1957. And okay. I was at NC State And there was a diversity of young men, mm-hmm. predominantly young men, and they had much more life experience than I did. I was really naive. I was from a small southern textile town, and when I was a young man, I just wanted to make good grades. I was encouraged by my parents to make good grades, and I was energetic in public school and had a lot of friends. I was in the band, and I didn't do any athletics, but mm-hmm. my very best friend played baseball and played basketball, and he was my best friend throughout his life. He died a few years ago, mm-hmm. and so I would say being in college is important developmentally. I mean, we know now from psychological studies mm-hmm. that a lot of men and probably women reach a kind of sexual maturity when they're in their early 20s. Mm-hmm. And that was true of me as well. When I grew up in a small textile town, I didn't know anything about gay men or gay women. But I think there were people who perceived me and recognized that probably I was different, mm-hmm. even though I didn't recognize it at that time.
Yeah.
And I remember during one summer job that I had in an oil filter factory, and there was a man on the floor, and he kept staring at me. Very handsome man, very popular with women, mm-hmm. but he kept staring at me and making me feel somewhat self-conscious. And I think that he knew. He knew I was a gay man mm-hmm. before I knew I was a gay man. And I thought that was interesting, and I often think of him. And his mm-hmm. he was very popular among women.
What about the guys? If he was that pretty, could he have been gay himself?
I don't think he was gay. Mm-hmm. I think he had a lot of sexual experience with whomever he wanted because he was strikingly handsome and suave, very mm-hmm. suave. At lunchtime at the mill, everybody came out of the mill and they would pile into their cars and they would drink White Lightning.
Oh, my God.
And they threatened me at that time. They said, Harry, you're going to drink White Lightning before you leave this place.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot of activity at lunchtime in the cars parked in the parking lot.
I couldn't believe that.
And
that is wild.
And I didn't know it. I didn't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
But many years later, I sort of put two and two together, and I saw that they were fraternizing mm-hmm. in their cars.
Okay. Well, to go back to college, you said it was in the 50s, so people weren't exactly overtly out then. So how did you meet gay people, gay men, at that point in time?
Well, I didn't really seek them out, but I don't know if this is true of women, but it's certainly true of men.
Mm-hmm.
If a man makes eye contact with you and keeps the eye contact with you,
mm-hmm.
it is extremely flirtatious, and it's an invitation.
Man to man.
Uh-huh. Man to man, and it's an invitation to get to know each other sexually.
Okay.
And it's somewhat subtle, but if you're in that environment and it happens over and over again, finally, unless you're so obtuse that mm-hmm. it happens over and over again and you kind of pick it up, it's mm-hmm. a bit of a learning experience.
Right.
It's like a language learning experience, and mm-hmm. it is a language learning experience. It's just done without words initially.
I guess part of what we would call gay culture.
Gay culture, sure.
Yeah, that would make sense.
So, you know, at that time, it's a period of sexual maturity in men, early 20s. Mm-hmm. We know that from psychological studies.
Right.
And perhaps among women as well. So there's a lot of that in the environment, even though the environment is oriented toward learning. And if you're in an engineering school,
mm-hmm.
it's very challenging and time-consuming.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, you're still at a point in your life where you're constantly getting new tools, social
right.
tools, intellectual
mm-hmm.
tools. And it's quite interesting in retrospect.
Okay. Yeah, and you talked, college, but then I know, you know, we in our conversations, you had two what sound like very happy marriages to women.
I did.
So you started seeing gay culture then. Why did it take till 74 to start, you know, feeling like you could live that way when you saw it then? Go ahead.
Right. Well, I wanted to have a, quote, normal life. I wanted to be married, and I wanted to have children. I wanted to have that full, rich experience.
And we're talking 50s, 60s,
that's
when
right.
that was 50s really
and
kicking
60s.
In. Yeah.
And so I had dated when I was in high school. I knew I was pretty attractive to women. And so when I went to graduate school, I met a woman. And I married her. She was an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. And we had a very happy marriage, had two children pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And so I felt very comfortable in that role. In addition to that, if you worked for the federal government, which I did for many, many years,
okay.
There were no options, no other sexual options. You lived as a straight person, mainly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could not be gay.
You couldn't be gay.
Weren't the McCarthy witch hunts that included, you know, bashing people for being gay? That was the 50s, right?
Mid-50s. That's right. So I had a great experience as a husband and as a parent. I had two wonderful boys, and my wife got sick at one point, and what turned out to be a terminal illness, and she died after over 20 years of marriage. And then I met another lady, and I guess she found me attractive. And my kids were in high school at that time. And I started dating her, and we got married and had a very happy marriage until she also contracted cancer. We had a long, very good marriage. Mm-hmm. She was a professional. And so at that time, the gay issue, let's say it was always in the back of my mind. It mm-hmm. was in the back of my mind. It was intrinsic to who I was.
Right. It never went away.
And then after Barbara died, a year after Barbara died, I thought to myself, okay, Harry, you're pretty far along in life. You don't know anything about being gay. Why don't you try to learn a little bit? So I lived in a suburb of Washington, D.C., and a minister at the Unitarian Church was known to be gay, and I called him up, and I said, Scott, I don't know anything about being gay. Can you help me? Can you help me mm-hmm. understand and experience this? And he said, I'll have a friend of mine, a minister in the District of Columbia, call you.
Mm-hmm. About and what year was that? Can you?
I was 74 years old, 74 plus 1936.
Okay. So in the 2000s.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And so Scott said, a friend of mine, also a minister in D.C., will call you up and he'll make some suggestions. And Scott, his friend called me up. Ben South was his name. Ben called me and said, on Thursday night, go to the Italian Pizza Kitchen at DuPont Circle, and you'll meet a dozen really nice guys. And I did that. And that was the beginning of my gay life.
Wow.
And being a friendly person, mm-hmm. comfortable with meeting people, I quickly met people in the District of Columbia and in Montgomery County, and also at the National Institutes of Health, which has been our foremost science community. Mm-hmm. And they had a gay group called Salutaris, and I began going to socials with this group, and I felt immensely comfortable with them. And so learning to, and then of course I learned. I went to socials, and I knew I wasn't making a mistake in my life. That I was, mm-hmm. I was entitled to experience life as a gay man. I hadn't done it, and I was entitled to that mm-hmm. because this is the only life you have. And if you don't seize the opportunity, then the opportunity will dissipate, mm-hmm. disappear.
Well, I think it's really powerful to hear that, you know, you adapted to your time period. I mean, you adapted to what was going on. And to do the things you wanted, to have kids,
right.
to have a career, because I did look for you online, like
right.
I said, and
sure.
you have your name's by a lot of papers.
I did.
And you worked for the Division of Vital Statistics
right.
as part of the CDC
right.
and did a lot of, I think, really important work.
I did, and I'm quite proud of some of the things I did. I co-chaired the National Committee that gave HIV its name. It had no name initially.
Really?
And CDC put together a committee, and I was the co-chair, and initially, you know, we named it by its manifestations, like Kaposi's sarcoma.
Right.
We didn't know what the umbrella term was.
Mm-hmm.
And so we created a vocabulary. And it was exciting to be involved and participating. Not because I was gay, but because it was scientifically meritorious.
Mm-hmm.
So in this area of giving names to things, anytime there is a new medical diagnosis, you have to give it a name and add it to the medical vocabulary. So another big event was 9/11. When 9/11 occurred, we had no terminology for deaths and illnesses due to terrorism. And we had to work with the FBI and create a vocabulary for deaths and illnesses mm-hmm. due to terrorism. There were a few countries that did. Israel did. Ireland did. They had a vocabulary. So what we did was to take some of the existing terminology
right.
and we adapted it to the environment in the United States. And again, It was interesting, it was important, and it stayed with me as a contribution to science and biostatistics. And
right.
I just felt so privileged to be able to do these things.
Because that is what these vocabularies do, right? They help us get closer to the truth of what's really killing people. And, you know, and I guess that can give you insights into where to put policy and funding.
That's exactly right.
To help, you know, to help avoid or fix that.
Yes, so. we used our statistics from the National Center for Health Statistics to create the budgets of agencies that dealt with diseases. How important is this disease? We need to give money.
Right.
Heart disease, cancer, stroke are the big three.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to give money, budgets, so that we can do research and come up, hopefully, with sound scientific scientific contributions.
Yeah, and I would get proportion. One way you would look at proportioning the money is, you know, how many people is this affecting.
That's right.
Right? That's not the only criteria.
No, but it's very important.
Yeah, and if you don't have the vocabulary and the related codes and everything else, you can't do an analysis on the data.
And you can't make rational decisions, and you can't justify the decisions because Congress is going to say, how come you want so many billions of dollars for cancer research?
Right.
And you can say, the reason I do this is because there are so many millions of people who die every year
mm-hmm.
from cancer, and that's the justification. And that's how you can justify it to your constituents,
right.
because you need to do that.
Right. And so data you can trust.
That's right.
And analyze is what we need. Just
right.
putting that out there in the world now in a time when expertise is being lambasted by people who want to make judgments based on their whims. Okay,
right.
I'm just going to leave it at that.
Well, I want to just tell you one other thing. It was a bit of a perk for my job, and that was almost every year we would have the people who did the kind of work I did. We would meet in another national capital. So Tokyo, Buenos Aires. I mean, you think it was unreal. So I've always been a runner.
Uh-huh.
And so I've run in all of these places. And the first place I ran was in Canberra, Australia, which has a lake that has a track around it. And I ran around the lake, and I met somebody else who ran around the lake with me, and we became lifelong friends. But wherever I went, I would run. I would always bring my running shoes, and it was exciting, and you meet people, and it sounds a little exotic, but it's one of the perks of being having a job that is actually challenging and difficult and interesting. So
yeah.
It was great.
That's great. I was just curious, with these meetings, were they just with U.S.-based scientists or were the international also?
They were international because there's a essentially a dictionary called the International Classification of Diseases. And it initially, in the 19th century, it had just a few diseases in it that killed people or made them extremely ill. And this grew and grew, and now it has thousands of categories in it. And so this is called the International Classification of Diseases. And back 20, 30 years ago, for the first time, we began using these categories for medical reimbursement. So if you look at a bill, a medical bill, often it will have a code of 3 or 4 digits. And that is because this classification system is now also used for medical reimbursement.
Okay. So, it sounds like the vocabularies you helped create for, you know, the different things you talked about are part of this now.
Oh, they are. They're an integral part of medical reimbursement.
Yeah, wow. And I had no idea what an impact you had.
Well, I not personally, but...
Well, but yeah, as a group,
yeah,
a group, right?
I was involved in it, and it was an exciting medical career. And in addition to that, I did other things. I taught at UNC, and I worked for the largest research firm probably in the world, which is located in Columbus, Ohio, and it's called Battelle Memorial Institute. And it was a small company that did metallurgical research. And it has evolved into one of the largest research organizations in the world. They have laboratories now in Germany and in Switzerland, Long Beach, California. And I had the privilege of working for them for almost 10 years. And because I personally was very involved in the anti-war movement when we were fighting in Southeast Asia, I met political people in Ohio. And so when we got a governor, a Democrat governor, they offered me a job in the government of Ohio. And I was the deputy director of one of the departments, and I was the head of the, quote, Office of Economic Opportunity, the War on Poverty, and that was another piece of my life.
Right.
And it was interesting and wonderful, and it was only because initially I was an anti-war nick, and I got involved in the Eugene McCarthy campaign for president. And I got involved in politics, and I'd never done that. It was furthest thing from my mind. But I had this really exciting job until the governor lost the election, and everybody got fired. So we got another governor. But anyway, it's another facet of my life that is really interesting.
And things you really enjoy doing. I mean, I can just tell people can't see what you look like, but you're smiling and your eyes are sparkling when you talk about this.
Well, you know, how lucky. I've been so lucky. I never forget how lucky. I think God has watched over me. We haven't talked about my coming to the United States. in 1940.
And if you want to move in that direction, we can do that. Go ahead.
Okay. So,
do we need to pause for just a quick...
We could do a station break.
Let's do a quick pause.
Okay,
right?
Sure.
Coming right back to this.
I just want to let everybody know that we, our hosts for this program, are members of the LGBTQ plus senior resource team with the Orange County Department on Aging. And we're bringing you a potluck dinner and movie at the Seymour Center in Chapel Hill on December 3rd. The potluck is at 5:30, followed by the screening of The Holiday Sitter, a fun rom-com for the holiday season.
And a gay rom-com for the holiday season.
Oh, yes. Register by calling 919-968-2070. Join us to share some holiday love. It's a space for everyone to feel seen, safe, and to celebrate who we are for one another. That's December 3rd at 5:30 at the Seymour Center. Please call 919-968-2070 to register. Now, back to you, Betty.
Okay, Harry. Yes, this was one of the things I wanted to talk about because, you know, you didn't just grow up in Gastonia, North Carolina. I did not know until the last 2 days that you and your family, you know, you're a Holocaust survivor.
Right. We are.
So please say what you want to say about that.
Okay, I'll tell you. On Crystal Night, November 1939... our apartment in Magdeburg, Germany, was invaded by Nazi soldiers. They tore up the apartment, brought us out into the courtyard in the November cold air, and my mother said, "Are you going to kill us?" And the sentry said, "I don't know yet."
My God, how old were you?
I was 4 years old,
okay.
And my brother was 4.5 years older than I was. He was already in public school.
Mm-hmm.
And so the soldier said, I don't know if I'm going to kill you. And it turns out he didn't kill us. And they let us go back into our apartment, which had been ransacked and everything damaged. And I slept on the floor. My brother slept on the floor on a mattress. And in the morning, early in the morning, the Nazi soldiers came back to our apartment and they arrested my father. And they basically took him to the Buchenwald concentration camp as they did over 100 other men.
Why did they arrest him?
Because
what did
he was
say?
Jewish.
And that was
everybody,
it.
Everybody they arrested was Jewish and they were put in the concentration camp. And since our apartment was hardly habitable. My brother was sent to live with relatives in Frankfurt, Germany. I was given to another family. I was 4 years old, pretty traumatized by all this activity.
Right.
And my mother went to live elsewhere. And my mother, the gutsy lady that she was, she went to the Gestapo. And she said, "If you let my husband out of the concentration camp, we will leave Germany as soon as we can get our affairs in order." And they let my dad out of the concentration camp, which was a miracle.
Wow.
And we moved to Holland, the Netherlands, to Rotterdam for a year, lived in a refugee camp, and then took the last ship out of Holland before it was invaded by the Nazis. And that was the end of the emigration from Holland. And so one of the interesting highlights of that experience, I would say, is that in this refugee camp, there were children running all over the camp. And my father's sense of order would not allow that. And he said, "These children should all be in school." And so he arranged to have books collected from the other refugees who were in the camp, and the kids started going to school.
Wow.
So the Dutch authorities were so impressed with my father's work that they said, Rudy Rosenberg, when the war is over, we want you to organize the school system for the Jewish community that we're going to establish outside of Rotterdam. Well, my dad was felt this was a compliment, but he was also terrified that we would not be able to get out of Europe. And so ultimately we did get on the last ship out of Holland and we came to the United States. And I'd like to tell a story. I'm 4 years old and they show a movie. I've never seen a movie before. They showed The Wizard of Oz.
Oh boy, your first movie.
And when
movie.
I heard Judy Garland sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow, that was it. I was gay. That was it. And I like to tell that story. Anyway, we came to New York City. We arrived in Hoboken, New Jersey. My brother went to public school for a year in New York. I, unfortunately, had been totally traumatized. I had been moved around too much. I felt the world was chaotic, and I was hardly functional. And it took a few years for me to stabilize because it was simply too much chaos at a very formative period in a child's life. And eventually I did. We moved to North Carolina. My dad got a job, and life assumed a natural order, made friends, and I felt very, very lucky, and ultimately went to the University of North Carolina, got a bachelor's degree, and then eventually got a PhD, had a wonderful career after that, especially working for CDC, but I also did some obviously other fairly exotic things mm-hmm. that were interesting and wonderful. And until my second wife died, I lived as a straight man. And it was a very rich life, and I have two wonderful boys and four wonderful grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And I have been, as they say, I've been blessed. So.
Yeah, you told us about your process of coming out like to yourself. How was that with, I mean, it seems like at that time when you were 74, you had kids, you had siblings, right? A sister and a brother.
Yes.
How was it coming out to them, and how did that go for you?
How did it go for me? I guess I decided that it was my business to live my life. And I didn't consult with anyone but the pastors in the Washington area. I thought, this is mine. This is nobody right. else's. And I'm going to do this and see where it leads me. Mm-hmm. And
I think your kids were adults by this time.
They were adults by that time. So. And I was very close to my kids. I continue to be very close to my kids. They're wonderful adults and wonderful parents. So I just feel I've been very fortunate all the way.
Mm-hmm.
My sister, who was trained as an architect and an attorney, she knows gay people because they were in school with her, and she had a lot of gay friends who
right.
were architects. My brother had a very difficult time accepting the fact that mm-hmm. I was gay. He couldn't get his head around it. And I just sort of, I didn't try to persuade him, although I have taken David DeMarini's excellent presentation in your program.
Right.
And I've recommended it to other people. And I think so many are surprised that the gayness is determined like in the first or second week of life. Mm-hmm. It happens. It's a physiological process, and it's there, and you don't have control over it. Psychologically, it's embedded in your biology and in your psychology, and there it is. So my brother has tried to absorb this, mm-hmm. but I think it's been very difficult for him, and that's all right. We're still good friends. And
good. I'm glad to hear that.
But you know, I'm not unusual. I'm sure anybody who comes out has a unique experience.
I think you're
either
right.
Positive or negative.
Mm-hmm. And or a mix.
Too often it's negative. Yeah. But mm-hmm. sometimes with understanding parents, it can be mm-hmm. okay. I read in the paper, I guess today, that gay Russians are going to Argentina now, and they find Argentina a very supportive environment. So not every environment is supportive, mm-hmm. but I've been lucky. I live in the United States. We accept gay marriage. Mm-hmm. We celebrate gay marriage. So we're just very lucky to be in this country.
I think you're right. Thanks for talking about how different family members responded, because I think it's, you know, it throws an interesting wrench in things when you come out after having been married twice, having kids, and here you are in your 70s, and I think people have trouble wrapping their head around that. It's like, well, weren't you straight? And you kind of, you weren't. It was the way you chose to live your life, because it allowed you to do the things you wanted.
But in my heart, I was gay.
And you knew it the whole time.
I knew it mm-hmm. the whole time. And the wonderful thing at this point, and I'm an older guy, but I have had gay partners, and I say that plural. Mm-hmm. I've had a number of partners whom I loved. And love, and it's just been an incredibly rich experience. I can't put words to it. It's poetry. Mm-hmm. I need poetry to talk about how rich the gay experience has been, and it's not only with individuals, but it's also community, mm-hmm. in the sense of community. And you meet some gay people, as I'm meeting you. Mm-hmm. And you, and I immediately feel a connection with you, that we've all had to navigate the challenges of life as gay people, and we've survived up to this point, and it's a privilege, and it's a blessing that I have to bring God into this, that God has enabled us to live the life that we feel in our hearts. Mm-hmm. And
I have a question for you, Harry.
Sure.
I'm interested in your spiritual journey. How is your spiritual life now? How did it come to be what it is now?
That's a really good question. I grew up initially as a secular Jew, very common. But in my teens, like so many people who were my age, I was searching for meaning, sort of existential meaning, and I read a lot. And I read a lot. And I thought a lot about these things. And so an incident occurred in my adult life that changed everything for me. And that was the following. My kids were in high school. My wife had just died. And I was going to the grocery store in Bethesda, Maryland. I was driving my station wagon. And suddenly I felt a presence next to me. And it was my wife who had just died. And she was, her presence was sitting next to me in my car on the way to the grocery store.
Did you feel her touch you or anything, or you just felt
no,
she
I just
was
felt,
there?
No, I felt that she was there.
Uh-huh.
And then this went on day after day for a week. And I spoke to her oncologist, her physician, and I said, my wife's presence has been in the car for a week. And he said, that's really interesting. I'd like for you to speak to my medical students. So I went to his medical students at George Washington University, and I told them about my caregiving experience, and then I told them about my wife's presence. And I said, I didn't know what to make of this, but she was there. And the only thing I could think of was that she was very reluctant to leave her children, that they were the most important thing to her. And but what happened was this experience was so real to me that it altered my perception of life and the afterlife. And I have become persuaded that there is a life after death, and there is a presence and a consciousness after death. And for me, as an individual, I know that. I can't convince anybody else of it. But the important thing is that it's removed my fear of death completely, that I don't believe that I will be alone. I think that I will be with the whole community of people who have passed on and are part of this great consciousness that we don't really have a good name for. We call it God, but there is this consciousness, and we're all part of it when we're alive, and we're part of it after we die. So that was this experience of driving to the grocery store that changed my view of life and spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've talked to other people, and I'm not unusual. There are other people, but it did open. It opened a whole new world for me. And what can I say? So I'm interested in afterlife experiences, mm-hmm. and I'm also interested in the science of life after death.
Have you read anything about that? Do you have any insights on that? I'm just curious.
Well, there are a lot of YouTube things. If you're a mm-hmm. YouTube,
I do.
Junkie.
Yes.
If you're a young YouTube junkie, there are quite a few things that mm-hmm. will persuade you that there are individuals who have technically died.
Mm-hmm.
But the experience, they come away with some new experience. They're new people. They are a unique species unto themselves.
Right.
And they can't really communicate this effectively because it's so unique. But I feel like my life changed when my wife came back to me on the way to the grocery store.
What a great, great story. Thank you so much.
That's
a very moving story to me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I feel I was blessed to have that experience.
It really is. I was just wondering. Oh. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm doing this. I was looking on YouTube just now, and I'm wondering if you've ever watched any of the videos that Dr. Mayim Blalock has done. She does a blog. And has been interviewing people with who've had near-death experiences. I haven't watched any yet,
right?
But I have discovered this. And have you seen any of hers?
Oh, I have. I don't know that I've seen her.
Okay.
I may have seen them,
okay.
But I've watched a number of them, and
okay.
It only reinforces what my personal experience was, right. that it wasn't unusual, and that and it, to some degree, has removed my fear of death. I mean, I feel like, you know, I'll just see all my friends, and we'll sit around and drink a Carling's Black Label beer and have a good time.
That sounds like fun. I want to be there, too. Well, I just, the main reason I asked about her is that she comes at it from a scientist's point of view. So, you know, if you haven't, I'll share this with you.
Okay.
Privately.
I'd appreciate it.
Really, really good stuff. So, yeah, thank you. And Judy, thanks for the question. Because I, you know, in our conversations the last day or two, your spirituality has popped out. I mean, you're grateful to God.
I am.
Absolutely
grateful to God.
And, you know, and very solid in that. And that's a pretty, you know, some people think gay and, you know, and being spiritual don't mix. And
they do.
For sure.
And yeah, you know, because we're reflective, because things didn't come easily to us, and we thought about who are we? How do we fit into this world? Why are we different from anybody else? Now we know there's a scientific answer.
Right.
But there's also this huge social dimension that we participate in and we grow in. And
it's nice. pretty joyful, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah,
it is.
The other thing I think that my personal life, it's made me very sensitive to other people's life experience and their pain, and I see it. And I it's not my profession, but I see their pain, and I would like to be able to help them. But, you know, so much of this is highly individual. Mm-hmm. It's based on your personal experience.
That is so true. My experience of you, Harry, is that when we share space together, I definitely feel heard and I feel seen. And I thank you for that. That's something you bring into the room.
Thank you.
I can second that.
Yeah.
Big time. So let's bring it to today. You're 89. What's your life like today? You know, I see you as a role model, honestly.
Well, that's
and all. So I'm just wondering how, you know, I see how you move in the world. What do you do to keep yourself healthy, to keep yourself happy? You know, can you share a few things with us about that?
Well, I'm very self-disciplined about what I eat and how I maintain myself. Mm-hmm. Because if you're not healthy, that's such an impediment, such, and I do have some physical issues, but I'm self-disciplined, so I eat mainly vegetarian, and I work out, and I'm very self-conscious about working out, and so a lot of this has to do with the self-discipline that elderly people who have to. They have to maintain themselves. They can't let themselves go. So it is a discipline. It is a self-discipline. Mm-hmm. And if you know what you need to do, like I have a room in my house which I call my gym, and every morning when I get up, I do a set of exercises, and it's integral to my life and keeps me in a very good mood. And it goes back to something else. When I was in my 20s, I often had periods of depression, which is endemic in my family. Not my kids, but my father's family had a lot of mental problems. And I periodically would get depressed. And I read a book by a physician at Harvard, and I'm now in my early 20s, And I read this book, and he said, try running. And I started trying running.
Okay.
And it was magic. I had never had another bout of depression, ever, ever, ever. I never even got close. As soon as I began running, mm-hmm. it changed my body chemistry.
That's pretty amazing.
And I told my children the uh-huh. same thing, because I said, you know, you guys are also, you share my genes.
Right.
And there is a solution, and the solution is run. And obviously that's generic, and it could be any number of things. But right. maintaining yourself physically is really important.
Mm-hmm.
So I work out, and I have poor vision, so I can't really read very well. But the New Yorker, which I get, and I'm a great advocate. I think it's a wonderful magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And the New Yorker, it will read to you. So
nice.
All of the articles, you can get them to read to you.
Mm-hmm.
And
I did not know that.
A great compensation for this physical limitation that I have.
Right.
And I try various exotic things, and there isn't really a good solution for macular degeneration. Millions of people have it.
Right.
And
it's not a, you can't fix it with diet and all that
you
stuff.
You can't fix it with diet. No.
Mac has that, and he mm-hmm. loves the New Yorker, and I didn't know he could listen to it.
And it's,
that is great news.
It's slow, but
it's okay.
It's great.
Thank you.
So it's a wonderful resource. So I manage, mm-hmm. and you know, and I have a lot of intellectual curiosity ever since the experience with my wife
right.
coming that changed my mm-hmm. life, and in a million different ways. And I think people should not despair over death, because it mm-hmm. is not the end. It is not the end. It's merely a transit point. Things will be different,
mm-hmm.
but it isn't the end. And I can say that with a fair amount of confidence now. I've read enough.
Nice.
I've seen enough. I've heard enough so that mm-hmm. it really removes the fear of death for me.
Good.
And,
Thank you so much.
Thanks for sharing that with us. And, yeah, can I do one? One more quick question, because we're almost at the time where we have to finish. In a few sentences, what would you tell an older person especially who's never been able to be out as gay but has felt it all their lives? What would you tell them today?
What would I tell them? I would say try to make friends with other gay people and ask them how they navigated this issue in their life. Speak to people, because we're all individuals. We all have different circumstances, and learn how the other people navigated it. That's the best. That's the very best thing.
Mm-hmm.
And do not isolate yourself socially, especially people who are gay are friendly, and they can enrich your life, and they can give you confidence, and just talk to people and make
Great.
Friends. That's the best medicine, as far as I know.
Great. Thank you, Judy. Over to you.
Thank you so much, Harry. Well, I feel blessed to have had this hour with you. Thank you. And thanks again to WCOMLP, Chapel Hill Carrboro at 103.5 FM, and the Orange County, North Carolina Department on Aging for making Out on the Edge possible. Thank you, listeners, for your support and for sharing our stories beyond Orange County. Archived shows are posted at orangecountync.gov/OOTE. Do you have questions or ideas for future shows, or just want to share some love? Contact us at outontheedgeradio@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Now let's start this new week with a bit of joy, which we have actually had for the last hour.
Yes.
Khalil Gibran reminds us, in the sweetness of friendship, let there be laughter and sharing of pleasures. In the dew of little things, the heart finds its morning and is refreshed. Thank you all. Peace out.